Welcome to Making Therapy Better, the podcast that brings together some of the top minds in psychotherapy and related fields to talk about how we can achieve better mental health care for everyone. Making Therapy Better is hosted by Professor Bruce Wampolt, who has dedicated his career to understanding how therapy works and advocating evidence-based methods for improving outcomes. His guest today is Daisy Singla, PhD. Daisy is a clinical psychologist, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto, and senior scientist with the Institute for Mental Health Policy Research at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. She has led some of the largest clinical psychotherapy trials in the world, exploring methods for increasing access to mental health services in a diverse range of cultures and settings. She has received awards from the American Psychological Association and the Society for Psychotherapy Research, and in 2018 she became the youngest ever recipient of the Pragmatic Clinical Study Award. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths has been helping in-person and virtual therapy practices thrive for over 20 years with their complete web-based EHR and practice management platform. CarePaths provides free tools to help therapists as well as clients benefit from the power of measurement-based care to improve therapy outcomes. Visit carepaths.com to start your free trial, and clients should look for the free Making Therapy Better app, now available for iPhone and Android. And now, without further ado, episode 19 of Making Therapy Better, Closing the Global Mental Health Care Gap, with Daisy Singla, PhD.
So Daisy, this is a real honor and opportunity to talk to you about the work you're doing in low and middle income countries. This is a very important topic for a number of different reasons we'll get into. So we know the prevalence of mental disorders is increasing all over the world and in low and middle income countries, particularly, well, maybe not particularly, because in the United States, it's increasing dramatically as well. In all of these locations, access to care is just problematic. You know, it's different in various countries, but it's the access is an issue wherever you go around the world. So you're deeply involved in developing what I would say innovative treatments for low and middle income countries. So take a few minutes and tell us about the treatments. Who delivers them? Just the background. And then we'll get into some of the important details. And I do want to take time to talk about the implications for care in higher income countries in the United States particularly. But give us the background.
Sure. So you want a background on essentially what we're doing in low middle income countries?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great. So first of all, it's great to be here, Bruce, and to connect with you after some time. You know, the reality is that as you indicated, the reality is that worldwide individuals aren't receiving adequate mental health care. So in low middle income countries, and I've worked primarily in South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, you know, the treatment gap is as high as 95%. That's in so many ways unethical. Given so, that we know.
So you mean 95% of people who could benefit from mental health care?
People, exactly. 95% of people who don't have access to effective mental health care. And we know that, as you indicated, not just in low and middle income countries, but worldwide, there seems to be fewer and fewer specialists available to deliver these effective treatments. And so what we've done, and really this has been going on since the 1950s and actually was developed in the US, tested in the US and the UK, is to train non-specialist providers. So these are individuals without a formal degree, without formal training in mental health care, and yet we can train them to screen and treat common conditions, including depression and anxiety, worldwide. The treatments are typically brief, you know, 10 sessions at most, And they really build on effective cognitive, behavioral, and interpersonal components that we know have been demonstrated to be helpful for a variety of conditions. My particular focus is on depression, anxiety, and trauma-related disorders.
Which, as we know, are the most prevalent disorders worldwide. Yeah. So this is really fascinating. So non-specific practitioners, say a bit more about how you select and train these providers.
Yeah, so the cadre of provider really depends on the context. For example, in India, we work extensively with community healthcare workers. In many states in India, in fact, in almost all states in India except for two, there's something called accredited social health activists, or ASHAs. Hmm. And these are women who are typically resident of the community that they serve. They serve up to 10,000 individuals in that area, focused on things like women and child health, immunizations, among a range of other things. And what we found is that they're actually really interested and motivated to also learn about mental health. Mm-hmm. In India, a common term for depression is tension. And what we noticed is that many people are experiencing tension, reduced sleep. They can't sleep, they can't eat, and it's affecting their daily chores. And these ashas were extremely motivated to learn the skills to address this very common problem that they were encountering. They're typically, you know, between the ages of 25 to 45 years old. And it's been remarkable to see individuals, again, without any formal training or degree in mental health care, pick up these skills and essentially be able and feel really empowered to be able to deliver them to address this growing burden of depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. In North America, we've trained nurses and midwives and doulas to help perinatal populations in our healthcare settings. And going back to India, I've collaborated with the collaboration is really, really key in any context. And I've collaborated with my colleagues at Sangath. It's a local award-winning NGO who has excellent relationships and understanding of the community. And our team works with ASHAs extensively across the state of Madhya Pradesh, which is a state in central India.
Mm-hmm. So the providers are already integrated in the health system.
Exactly.
And they're actually seeing people probably who have a great need for mental health services anyway. So it isn't the case where we're going to have a referral to somebody outside of the primary care or the neonatal care or so forth. It's already the provider's got that integration.
Yeah, and that relationship is so key, as we know. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about leveraging existing systems to see where are people going for healthcare services and how to make it as easy as possible for them to receive this kind of care.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the United States, we're used to the model where there's a referral or there's a self-recognized need. You go to a specialist, make an appointment, have a psychotherapy session. Mm-hmm. But I know in many cultures, that's to see a mental health professional in that context is just weird. Okay.
It's weird and it's extremely stigmatizing for many mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And so one benefit of leveraging individuals in the community, frontline workers who have this existing relationship, is really destigmatizing what mental health typically represents in many of our societies, not just out there in low middle income countries, but also here in our high income countries as well.
Mm-hmm. So where is the treatment delivered then, if it's not in this kind of specialist office that we think of in the United States? Where would these providers actually provide the mental health services?
It really depends on the context. So in rural Uganda, we work with peer delivery agents, so community individuals from that same community who are not necessarily part of a healthcare system, but peers and interacting often with their colleagues. There were group sessions that took place, and often in under a mango tree or at a primary school setting. They did take place in groups. And so it's really about delivering the treatment where it's most feasible for individuals to attend. Obviously with COVID, it's really revealed that we can deliver treatments virtually. And so with the perinatal population, we know that they prefer telemedicine over in-person care. It helps overcome the common barriers of transportation and childcare and all, the logistics of getting to a specialist setting. So we've really learned to leverage telemedicine, particularly in middle to high income countries, to deliver these treatments. And I hope that we can continue to do that in other settings as well.
Yeah, especially in rural areas or where transportation is difficult. You know, several times you've mentioned it depends and the cultural context. So say more about how these programs are culturally, I don't want to use the word adapted, but culturally appropriate, and how they differ or may differ from one setting to another, and how you develop treatments, because this is complicated. I know cultures are complex, and it's difficult to really understand from an outsider what's appropriate. So how do you design the treatments for these various cultures?
Yeah, so there's lots of different approaches, Bruce, and there's been a lot of work describing culturally adapted treatments, culturally sensitive treatments, what components to include, what components not to include. I think for us, what's been a steady theme is leveraging a for us, with us approach, meaning that there's a genuine and active involvement and partnership with populations served. I'll go back to the example in rural Uganda. And by rural, I mean 350 kilometers north of the capital city. So there are no specialists in this setting. At best, there may be a few primary care settings. And we worked with local communities to determine appropriate language, appropriate materials to address maternal depression, intimate partner violence within a group parenting program. So the one thing that was very clear in Uganda was that people care about their children. And I don't say that lightly. People cared about their children growing up and being healthy. And once they recognized the link between mother and child, fathers were a lot more interested in not only attending programs, but finding out what could they do to support their child and their partner. Going back to cultural adaptations, we didn't use any pen and paper, as we may use in traditional cognitive behavioral therapy. We sometimes assigned homework, but more so activities. And we avoided any medical jargon. So nowhere in that manual will you find the term depression, or at least I don't think you will find the term depression. You'll find terms such as love and respect, which really came from the community and from my partner, Elise Kumba-Kumba, who's a pediatrician, one of a few pediatricians in Uganda, but was very keen on using terms that made sense, especially when translated and back translated from the local language. So I think language is extremely important. I think also another adaptation that we commonly think about is who would be the most appropriate individual to deliver the program. So again, with the case of this group parenting intervention in Uganda, it was not appropriate to have female peers deliver this program to a group of men. So there's individual sessions for fathers. And it became clear that, again, based on stakeholder input and feedback, it became very clear that there were certain men who had certain men in the community who had a really good reputation, and they would be excellent spokespeople for the given program. And it became very clear that if they were delivering the program and interested to deliver the program, it would be that much more powerful. So it's not about me as a complete foreigner with a very thick Canadian accent coming in and delivering the program, or even providing trainer. We really facilitate a train-the-trainer model. And we've also found that it's really, really important to work with the community and really listen to what they say with regards to a genuine partnership.
Well, you know, I think most of us read about cultural adaptations and cultural sensitivity. Easier said than done, because you have to have that intimate knowledge. And clearly, you've done this partnership where the models are being developed by the local residents with your guidance. I mean, you have the expertise in mental health, but a collaborative project. That's time consuming. I mean, you're going into one area. So we want to talk about how to scale this up at some point, but let's save that just for a minute, because I'm still interested in the nature of the treatments. So you have this collaboration where the treatments really take into account culture in terms of the content, in terms of the language, and in terms of who delivers it. But the treatment, it sounds like, is guided by what we know about evidence-based treatments. You've mentioned cognitive behavioral treatment. So tell us more about the content of the treatments, both in terms of its kind of canonical material, but also the cultural adaptations.
Sure. So one of the programs that I had the pleasure of working on in India is referred to as the Healthy Activity Program. And the Healthy Activity Program is a behavioral activation focused treatment. It was reduced to 6 to 8 sessions from the original Healthy Activity Program. Sona Demijian was actively involved in helping to adapt that. And where the core principles of behavioral activation were retained, in the sense of if we think of one of the mantras of behavioral activation, in order to feel differently, you need to do differently. I'm paraphrasing, of course. So there was a link between what one was doing and how one is feeling. Mm-hmm. Now, where the adaptation might take place is the actual activities that one engages in. So the activities that a pregnant woman may engage in rural Bangladesh may be different than the activities that one engages in Canada or the US. But we all have meaningful activities that we want to engage in, and those tend to affect our mood. Another common principle is the interpersonal supports. So what we found is interpersonal supports actually mediate the effects. Increased interpersonal supports mediate the effects of many of our interventions on reduced perinatal depression. Mm-hmm. And I think if we leverage many of our activities to enhance social support, whether it's actively involving fathers or other family members into the program, or whether it's focusing on communication skills, really, in my opinion, the basis of this is extremely common. It's really just a matter of modifying the activities or the details according to that context. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but...
Well, yes, you are, but okay. I want to delve a little deeper.
Sure.
So
sure.
You've taken a program like behavioral activation and really adapted it for the local culture. So you've taken a principle that we know is important, and behavioral activation actually is found in most treatments for depression, not as deliberate as it is in behavioral activation. Interpersonal support, I want to talk about a little bit more. Are you talking about increasing the interpersonal support for the sufferer? I don't know, you probably don't talk about patients because that's part of the language that we use, but what term should I use for?
I think patient is fine. Some people prefer the word client. Some people.
Okay. But are you talking about the interpersonal support for the client or providing interpersonal support in the therapy process?
Both. Thanks for clarifying that, Bruce. Yeah. So the mere fact of having the opportunity to speak about one's mental health is novel in many of these contexts. Mm-hmm. It's not common. It's not expected. And so being able to sit in a safe space and be able to discuss some of these things is novel, and it's often seen as very much appreciated. So that's the support that the providers, the treatment provider would be offering. But also it's a matter of the sessions, and I think this is one of the lessons we could really enhance in North America. Individuals don't live typically in isolation. Again, if I think about the pregnant and the perinatal population, it's a time of huge transition. We know that when partners are involved in one's mental health care, in childcare, mental health improves. And so I think that there's also the opportunity to involve partners and extended family members, ensuring that they're on board, because there have been times when partners or community members may not be even aware of the program. And if they are gatekeepers and not aware, then there won't be any opportunity for that individual to participate. There won't be any opportunity for that individual to benefit from treatment because they can't even participate. So I think there's a lot of, background information that background work that goes in to not only deliver the treatment, but also set up communities, set up the healthcare system, set up the given setting to prepare the individual and potentially their family that this is something that's being offered. And that's where the collaboration with the community is so critical.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're really talking about a systemic approach to setting up the system. And I know our systemic colleagues will be happy to hear that. We know people suffering from mental illness are often ostracized or marginalized, at least in their communities. And it sounds like deliberately you're designing these programs to keep the patient integrated into their communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because when the program ends, the individual will still be part of their community. And we know that communities benefit when mental health is better. And so I think that there's a bi-directional benefit when communities are involved and when we are looking at things systemically.
Mm-hmm. And as deliberately you've designed this so that the patient doesn't feel like they're being identified as mentally ill.
Correct.
And going off to a provider. But this is just a health-promoting interventions that would benefit the community. So we've talked about behavioral activation, interpersonal support, the specific component. Mm-hmm. But I know from reading your work that the common factors or relationship issues are very important in the delivery of these treatments. So talk a little bit about how those intentionally are incorporated in the training and delivery of the services.
Sure, absolutely. So as you said, our research highlights the importance of both treatment-specific and common skills. And I have the pleasure of speaking with you, Bruce, about common skills. By common skills, I'm really referring to what's required in any treatment. So being non-judgmental, being collaborative, showing empathy, you know, that interpersonal effectiveness that we know is so key to getting someone to treatment, but also keeping them in treatment and having them benefit from what we're offering. I think it really starts, especially from a trial, from a research perspective, it starts with the selection of the providers. So in research settings, we actually assess interpersonal skills when we select providers. One way to do this empirically is to set up a mock interview with a mock patient or participant, saying, we know that you don't have a background in delivering mental health care, but how might you interact with an individual upon a first time meeting? And so we can get a sense of what their interpersonal skills are like. And when we have the opportunity in, especially with using Zoom, we're able to be in different settings to do that. But this can also work in in-person settings. With regards to common skills or with regards to assessing this quantitatively, we've actually developed various tools for assessing therapy quality. Which essentially assesses both treatment specific as well as common skills. And we found that that's a really important indicator for predicting not just patient behaviors, but ultimately patient outcomes. Yeah. And so I think this is really, really important in research settings, but also in clinical settings to get a sense of how are providers actually delivering these things. And while it's nerve-wracking at first to have your audio sessions recorded, and then rated and then scrutinized, what we found is people actually really, really, really like and feel that they benefit from this compass of a therapy quality tool. It's 20 items in most cases, to almost act as a guide for where they could improve specific skills and also more common skills.
Well, Daisy, you're describing kind of a prototypic model of how we should develop and implement and test treatments, because it isn't just enough to develop programs. We have to evaluate their effectiveness.
Absolutely.
And build in components of continuous improvement, which you've done. So that part's exciting. Let me talk a little bit about this idea of selecting providers with particular skill. And I'm interested in this because, as you know, in North America, we select people for graduate programs based on their grades, their GREs, all of these kinds of intellectual aspects. Rarely do we actually use some kind of instrument, and this probably has to be a behavioral test like you've done, where you actually watch the potential provider provide care. So we're going to talk about what can we learn in North America from these programs, and I'm going to put that on my list because I think we need to do here I'll editorialize. We need to do a more deliberate job of picking people who are going to be effective clinicians. Yeah. So, great. So, we've talked about selection. We've talked about the programs. Let's talk about training. So, how do you do the training? Because this is something different for the providers. They may have the basic skills, well integrated in the community, familiarity with the culture and so forth, but they still need training.
Yeah, absolutely. And training is important, as is delivering care under supervision. So the training typically consists of a 2 to 3 day workshop. These days, we're certainly leveraging digital platforms as well for training, where one can essentially attend an asynchronous workshop to learn a given treatment. We're not the only ones doing this. Many people are leveraging digital training in between watching those videos, there is the opportunity to interact with a clinical lead, practice one's skills, engage in, for example, Red Robins, where one is working within a group to see how they might respond to a given participant. Another method that we've used within training is for the individual themselves to go through the program as if they are the patient or as if they are the participant. And I think that elicits a certain level of empathy and a certain level of self-reflection that simply receiving the training passively does not, sorry, let me start again. I think that that level of engagement reflects a certain amount of self-reflection and empathy that wouldn't happen if one was simply passively receiving the training in a didactic model. Mm-hmm. So we've spoken about active and interactive strategies where one is not only engaging with the treatment, but in learning the treatment in sort of a group format, seeing one's peers engage with the trainer, interacting with each other through role play has been extremely effective. Now, this is not something that this is something that many people use. But what we're finding is that after training, each individual is typically assessed for competence through a standardized role play. And then they go immediately to see patients if they are deemed ready by the clinical lead and the supervisor to actually see participants. That includes, being prepared to attend safety protocols, knowing who to call, and obviously engaging in a collaborative way with the participant and following typically a manualized program. So training occurs for 2 or 3 days or half day workshops. It can occur over either virtually or in person, depending on the context. After that, there's typically a test for competence. We actually compared multiple choices, whether a knowledge test, whether a knowledge test or whether a standardized role play was predictive of patient outcomes. And we found that actually demonstrating one's skills through a standardized role play predicted patient outcomes, whereas simply having the knowledge did not.
Well, that's a result I've been involved in several different contexts. It's really important to understand that we need kind of this behavioral challenge test. How do you actually demonstrate skills in a challenging therapeutic situation? Much different than the knowledge test, and very specific. I mean, again, maybe I'm editorializing, but in our supervision models, we're often giving fairly general kinds of feedback. And even if it's more specific, there isn't really much opportunity to practice in that particular context. But you've built in role plays, video, round robins, all these activities so that you can give, it sounds like, very specific feedback about the skills.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll come back to that specific feedback in a moment, but I just wanted to explain training in maybe a more succinct way. So training typically consists of a 2 to 3 day workshop or half day workshop. It's done in person. It's done virtually. It's very active and interactive, as you had mentioned, with regards to role plays and round robins, with the opportunity for specific feedback. There's a test for competence. We prefer an actual standardized role play with a mock participant. And then individuals immediately start seeing patients under the supervision of a clinical lead, which is typically a clinical expert who has some foundation in the given treatment. And what we've extended that to is actually to engage in a peer supervision model where over time individuals, the non-specialist provider actually becomes the supervisor, not only the trainer, but also the supervisor. But with regards to specific feedback, sorry, just coming back to that, I think back to my days as a grad student, And if I think about Mirna Weissman's interpersonal psychotherapy was one of the first modalities that I learned. And I think about Mirna Weissman's guidebook on interpersonal psychotherapy. It was a tiny little manual. And she and her colleagues had specific words that an individual could provide in difficult situations. And I think it's not that I memorized those, or maybe I did at the time because I was so nervous seeing my first
teacher.
But it was really, really important to have those kinds of examples and that level of specificity so that I felt comfortable in the sessions. We find that as well with our manualized treatments. We offer specific scripts and quite a bit of structure so that, especially at the beginning, individuals have the confidence to know what to say and how to say it in a given session.
Right. And I mean, I'm so glad you're talking about this. And it takes practice to use those scripts till they become incorporated and can be delivered in a natural way. This is Tim Anderson's verbal fluency.
Yeah.
And people say, well, you know, we can't teach therapy by telling people what to say, but we can. That knowing what to say in various contexts is really important. That doesn't make it artificial or inauthentic. It's just a guide for navigating difficult interpersonal challenges in a way that's effective. We know it's effective.
Yeah,
and it takes practice to make that natural and effective.
For sure. For sure. I completely agree. And you'll see in many of the manuals for non-specialist providers and otherwise that those scripts are something that people keep going back to. And as you said, make it their own over time.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to comment on one thing so that it's clarified. When you say competence test, you're really using the word as applied to competence demonstrated in an actual therapeutic interview. It's not
Correct.
Some rating scale by supervisors or global measures. This is quite specific to that standardized interaction.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what strikes me is, I mean, this is fascinating and just so many components of it are commendable, all the way from design, selection, training, evaluation, and so forth. But it's extensive, what you're describing.
Yeah.
How do you scale this up? I mean, we began this interview by talking about the tremendous need across nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so 95% of the people are not accessing adequate treatment. This is pretty intensive. How could you possibly scale this up so that you could roll it out, let's say, at a region level, let alone a national level?
So actually in India, I completely agree with you, Bruce. And yeah, the scaling up is critical. I think we need to separate the research, which was required as a foundation to actually inform the scale up. So in most of the contexts that I've worked in, they are pragmatic contexts. They are not, and we've included a research component within that. I've also had the pleasure of working specifically within research trial designs. And I do think that there's a distinction between running a clinical trial and actually implementing this in the real world without, randomization, without all of these things. I think we're one step ahead in global mental health in terms of implementing our randomized control trials within pragmatic settings, as opposed to a very, very rigorous and controlled, research setting. I think about my colleagues at Sangath who are actually scaling up the healthy activity program, a brief 8-session treatment across multiple states in India. And competency is one thing, but I think it's about a lot of the principles actually stay the same. So you're asking about scale up. leveraging a digital training program, ensuring that one has competent supervision, potentially integrating peer supervision so that one doesn't become reliant on that on the dearth of specialist providers, and then implementing the treatment at scale, similar to models such as IAPT, with measures of the PHQ-9 and GAD-7, as one example, regularly and at regular time points. So at the beginning of sessions and then towards the end of sessions. So it may not be the whole, 3 month, 6 month, 12 month follow-up and all of the measures that we assess, but I think it's components of this that we're really seeing what is actually required in a real world setting and what are things that can be let go of. For example, ensuring that every single person requires a competency exam before they start seeing patients.
Well, you mentioned kind of scaling up the research component of this as well. And that was less a concern of me than scaling up the intervention to make it accessible. I mean, I think, this is why we evaluate programs from the beginning, so we can scale them up without having to do large-scale clinical trials. But it sounds like in this, you're also designing ways to scale it up. You talked about training the trainers, and that's a critical component, of course.
I think there's train the trainers, and there's also peer supervision, which is holding a lot of promise. So we, in most contexts, including here in North America, we cannot rely on the one individual who's trained in a given modality. So we found that supervision, one essentially transforms from being a naive learner, not having any knowledge or experience in that given in mental health care, to delivering treatments, to providing feedback to their peers, to ultimately becoming a supervisor. I think this is one example of scale that we could leverage in our real world settings here in North America. But I might be jumping the gun with regards to your questions, Bruce.
Well, we are going to get to that. But you know what's keeps coming to mind is something more personal. How did you get interested in this area? I mean, you're trained as a clinical psychologists, and there's lots of opportunities to both academic and clinically to that are rewarding. But here you are doing something innovative in two different continents. So I'm just curious about how you got to this point.
I think that's going to take longer than an hour interview. But,
okay. Short answer.
So I've always been interested in other cultures and the commonalities and distinctions between all of us as humans. I remember even as a little girl, just being fascinated by other people. And my parents' home was always one in which we had many different people and many different kinds of people coming into our home. And they were always very, very open to different cultures and continue to be to this day. I think with that foundation and being and traveling around the world alongside these transformative trials that came out in the early 2000s. So I'm thinking about Myrna Weissman's IPT trial that was conducted in rural Uganda. I'm thinking about Atif Rahman's Thinking Healthy program, which was a cognitive behavioral intervention delivered by lady health workers in rural Pakistan. These were, in my opinion, transformative interventions. And I thought to myself, wow, this is something that could really change the world. And it has. Shoot forward to 10 years. And I realized that this was actually applicable in our high-income country settings in Canada, in the U.S., where people also don't have access to treatment. And I thought to myself, okay, could we reverse engineer some of these treatments for our Canadian and U.S. context to improve access to mental health care. It almost became that, and the science behind what we do, you know, what we are implementing is founded on a robust evidence base. There's over 100, at this point, there's over 100 randomized control trials on this idea of task sharing, on this idea of training non-mental health specialists. In my opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't need more evidence on task sharing. We know that midwives, doulas, nurses, peers, community healthcare workers, teachers, you don't need to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist to deliver brief psychological treatments. Of course, there's a role for psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers. But I don't think it has to be only at the front lines of delivering psychotherapy. So in a nutshell, I saw the promise of this and I said, I have to be involved in this. How can I learn more?
A personal imperative is fascinating. But you really made the transition into what can we learn in North America, the United States and Canada, about access to mental health services. And you talked a bit about this, including this idea of reverse engineering. So say more about what we could do in North America to address the access problem and provide effective services to so many people who are not receiving it, and maybe in a way that's more optimal than our traditional models. But anyway, you're thinking about North America.
Yeah, I think there's lots of lessons to be learned, and I'll try to be succinct. But in my opinion, the biggest lesson is that we can optimize our systems, our healthcare systems, our community care systems, to essentially improve access to effective mental health care. We so often hear that there's a shortage of healthcare workers, and obviously COVID certified that perspective. But we have more people on the planet today than ever before. And I think that there's a real opportunity here to learn the skills that psychological treatments offer to address this growing treatment gap. I think there are huge lessons to be learned, and we've talked about some of them: stakeholder engagement, which is becoming more and more common in research trials, but stakeholder engagement as part of the research process, but also as part of the clinical care. I think thinking about the patient first in terms of patient-centered treatments rather than provider-centered treatments is going to be a really important mantra that we take on if we genuinely want to address the treatment gap. And I think that the roles of mental health professionals is really, really important here. If I think about our training as clinical psychologists, my supervisors had the foresight for us to also have some training in supervising more junior students. And for me, that was transformative because I was suddenly teaching others to provide treatments, which meant that there's more and more people who are able to offer treatments. What I'm trying to say is that the roles of mental health professionals are many. Even if non-specialist providers are offering treatments, there are opportunities to supervise, to teach, to train, to ensure quality treatment, to provide referrals, to monitor safety. We will never have enough individuals trained and supervised to offer these treatments. And I think there's a really important role for us as mental health professionals to address this treatment gap.
Well, you know, I tend to say when people raise, well, they're not fully trained, they can't recognize pathology, and it's going to eat into the professions in a way that's not optimal for the profession or for the patient. And I just say, there's always going to be enough patients for you. I mean, I know in my local community of Madison, finding a therapist with available openings is nearly impossible.
Absolutely.
So the digital solutions, the internet guided therapies, the nonspecific providers is helping address the access problem, doesn't take away from the role of professionally trained psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, licensed professional counselors. There's work for all of us to do.
Yeah, there's no shortage of work in mental health care. And I think that we can work more collaboratively and across systems to ultimately improve access to mental health care.
Part of the problem, of course, in the United States is the payment for services, because our whole system is built up around reimbursement for particular services given by particular people. So we'll leave that one to the policymakers, but we just have to understand how to navigate a complex, particularly in the United States, a complex health delivery system.
Actually, I do have something to say about that, Bruce. So within our summit trial, which is currently being implemented, we're comparing non-specialist providers to specialist providers delivering delivering a brief behavioral activation treatment. We're also comparing telemedicine to in-person psychotherapy for pregnant and postpartum populations with depression and anxiety symptoms. And what we found is the payers and the policymakers, some of whom are stakeholders, are actually really keen on the results. They're not only keen on the cost evaluation of these results, they're actually keen on finding out, well, there have been all these trials that have been conducted on task sharing, and very few have actually done a head-to-head comparison of non-specialist to specialist or of telemedicine to in-person. They want to know those results so that can ultimately inform their programs. And I think there's also a lot of potential for peers and peer delivery agents to be integrated into payer systems. So again, that we can address these policy gaps. And I recognize that it's state specific and it's a very complicated system. And we're not doing that much better in Canada with regards to access to treatment. But I do think that there is interest and potential for the idea of task sharing and how to integrate it within our policies.
So, I think that's an important message. By task sharing, tell us what you mean exactly, because that's a word that we don't often hear, but to understand it, particularly what you mean, I think is important.
Yeah, so task sharing is essentially what we've been talking about with regards to training non-mental health specialists to deliver, in this case, brief psychological treatments. It ultimately means sharing the task of psychological treatments to someone who is less specialized so that the entire system can be more optimized. It doesn't mean dumping the task on someone less specialized and that they have no support. It really means optimizing these systems because we know we have more people on this planet than ever before, and leveraging the skill of a mental health professional so that they can work on some of the things that we've discussed with regards to perhaps more severe patients or assessing the training and providing the training and assessing the quality and providing supervision, all things that are really, really critical to someone who may be more specialized.
Yeah, and it gets complicated with step care and tiered systems, patient preferences and so forth, but it's exciting to think about ways to address the access problem. I mean, in our field, we often argue about which treatments are more effective, and I've been part of some of those arguments, but that's not the central question. The central question is how we can address effectively access to care. And this is what you're doing in your work. This is inspiring, Daisy, both for the work you're doing internationally in different cultures, but the implications for addressing the access issue in higher income countries as well. So, you know, I've read your work, and talking to you, I realize how involved and busy you are doing this. And I think it's inspiring. It's inspiring to me, and I know it'll be inspiring to our audience. So I appreciate your spending the hour with us. So I'm just eager to see where this goes, because I think the potential is so great.
Thanks so much for having me, Bruce. It was great to be here.
Thanks for listening. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths offers a complete behavioral health EHR and practice management software solution, including claims, billing, clinical notes and documents, scheduling, and teletherapy, all for one simple and affordable monthly price. CarePaths EHR is HIPAA compliant and ONC certified, and can also support electronic prescribing for an additional fee. With CarePaths Connect, clinicians can enroll their clients in automated measurement-based care and create a digital front door for their practice. If you're just starting your practice or are dissatisfied with your current EHR, go to carepaths.com to start your free trial today. If you're currently in therapy and want to know how to get the most out of your treatment, check out the free Making Therapy Better app and visit makingtherapybetter.com.